Ladies and gentlemen, all around the Delaware Valley, welcome to the Saul Offer and Zervano Show here on WWDB Talk 860. We've got a fantastic broadcast. We're going to have our host, John Zervanos, calling in any minute. But so we're going to have a fantastic show. What's very interesting about today's show is that we're going to be talking about medical malpractice. And, you know, so it's such a misunderstood specialty. Okay, so, and John is one of the foremost medical malpractice attorneys, you know, in the Delaware Valley. And so, you know, we're going to talk about all phases of it. And certainly, you know, there's a lot of misnomers, okay, when you think about med mal. You know, it's not a situation where you can simply contact a law firm and just sue anybody, you know, because you're not happy with their personality. Here's what we're going to do. We're going to get into a situation where we're going to explain you have to certify, okay, when it comes to a medical malpractice case. You can't just sue any doctor. And by the way, nobody wants to sue doctors, and nobody wants to, you know, we're certainly not promoting that. We've got some great medical facilities. We got some great hospitals. We got some great doctors and all that, and we're real proud of them. You know, accountability is really important. And so when you talk about, you know, those types of things, okay, it's an area of the law that is incredibly misunderstood. So tell you what we're going to do. We're going to take a quick break, okay? And then when we come back, we're going to have John Zervanos on the line, and he's a partner at Saul Offer and Zervanos. You're listening to the Saul Offer and Zervanos Show here on WWDB Talk 860. We'll be back in a moment.
At home, at work, or on your travels, you don't have to miss a minute of your favorite WWDB shows. Download the free WWDB app to listen anywhere. You can also stream us live, listen to podcasts, and learn more about our great shows at WWDBAM.com. And you can always tune in on your phone or any smart speaker. Tell Alexa, play WWDB AM 860.
Are you missing your daily dose of Barry Reisman? Do you yearn for his Jewish musical stylings? Well, miss him no longer at WWDBAM.com, where you can listen to all the classic Barry Reisman and WWDB programming you could ever want. Once again, that's at WWDBAM.com, where you can find all the classic Barry and great WWDB programming.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the Saul Offer and Zervanos Show here on WWDB Talk 860. We are live on WWDB, and we have our host, John Zervanos, on the broadcast. John, how are you, sir?
Joe, I'm good. Thank you. Sorry about that confusion in the beginning.
No problem. It's live radio, John. It's live radio.
I've got to get better at it.
No, well, here's the thing. I'm going to blame Shane. He's our producer. I don't know what, you know. We have to blame somebody, even though he's the best in the biz. Just kidding, Shane. But so, John, like I was saying at the beginning, you know, I want to talk a little med mal and talk a little bit about you and the practice. Okay.
Yes.
And so, first of all, if you would remind our listeners a little bit about yourself and the firm, where you do business, you know, you're Zerbarden, PA, Jersey, and New York. Talk about that, if you would.
We have a Center City office here in Philadelphia, and we have lawyers who do a wide variety of personal injury work. I personally focus on medical malpractice cases. There's a couple other attorneys in our office who do medical malpractice. And then there's some of our practices dedicated to representing crime victims and sexual assault victims in the civil context. And then we do the garden variety cases involving auto cases and premises cases and work injuries.
It's interesting because personal injury does. It covers a lot of different areas. And you guys are, like you said, it's a wide array of specialties. One of the things I think, what got you, by the way, into medical malpractice?
That's interesting you ask. I grew up in a doctor's family. So I was around medicine from the time I was a kid. And I remember, my dad's patients would actually reach out to him. I remember going to church on Sundays. And at the end of the service, they would actually stop him and talk to him because even though we're third generation Greek, the immigrants would be there. And he was the only doctor in town that could speak Greek. And I would always be impressed with the time he would take to answer everybody's phone call, everyone's questions at the back of the church, at the end of church. And I would listen to him, and I just was found it fascinating. And then, of course, as I got older, one of my daughters had a very significant health issue. So I was exposed to more medicine. And somehow I just gravitated towards it because I'm interested in the issues. And, I like the challenge. It's a very, very challenging area of the law because, as every doctor will tell you, medicine is an imperfect science.
I'll tell you what's interesting. First of all, having done a lot of radio shows, talk about what we focus on is injury victims and workers' compensation, work injuries. You and I do a lot of political radio, and so you're engaged in a lot of areas. But one of the things I find amazing is the amount of Sullivan Cervantes is a very reputable firm. Like you said, you cover a large array of personal injury issues, and you specialize in medical malpractice. One of the funny things about it is you see a lot of law firms, especially small boutique firms, and they may be good at auto accidents or different smaller specialties, but they'll have on their website medical malpractice. On occasion, I'll have one of them lawyers on one of our shows, and I already know, based on the subject, by reading their website, they may be a very good attorney, but I'll already know that they don't really do med mal. Why is it that so many, and we're not going after any firms, there may be they may be good at certain things, but why do I see on the websites medical malpractice, and then when they come in, when they come into the broadcast, I'll sit there. I already know they don't do it, but the first thing I say to them is, "We're going to talk about medical malpractice." Just to humor myself, to take a look on their face before they say to me, "No, don't talk about medical malpractice." Now I know they just want to refer the cases out, but why do so few firms really do medical malpractice? And they may advertise it, but the fact is they don't really do it.
Well, I can't answer that question as to firms and specific firms as to why they choose not to do it. The thought, and of course my belief, is same reason why it took me a while to graduate, I'll call that, for lack of a better word, into the malpractice work, is one, it's very difficult. The defense lawyers that you are going to be up against are extremely competent. Most defense lawyers in the medical malpractice world do exclusively medical malpractice defense work, which means they're not going to be defending corporations for a defective product. More than likely not going to be defending a corporation for a defective product or an institutional defendant because they didn't abide by certain building codes. Their focus is on defending doctors and hospitals. And because their focus is defending doctors and hospitals, and that's all they're doing, you know, 5 days a week, 24/7, they're really, really good at it. And so you're going to be challenged. Awesome. The second reason, is they're extremely expensive. You can't take on a physician or hospital practice or a university hospital for negligence unless you have, sometimes it takes two or three or four experts to address the various causes of action. Namely, did the doctor breach the standard of care? And did that breach actually cause the injuries that you're alleging? So it's almost like a two-prong inquiry. Did the doctor breach the standard of care? And when he breached the standard of care, did it in fact, was it the factual cause for why this individual is now claiming injuries or some disability of some sort?
Okay.
So that's a difficult, that's very difficult to prove.
But you just jumped on something though, John, and that's, and this is one of the things, and we're going to dissect what you're talking about, especially when we get into breaching the standard of care and all that stuff. But resources, okay? That is where I was going. In other words, these cases, like you said, they can take a very long time. They are extremely, potentially extremely expensive because of the experts and the amount of time, okay, and all those things. And so the reason I bring that up is I think it's vitally important, okay, for listeners to understand that, especially because we're trying to educate the public on what they should be looking for when they have a situation where medical malpractice could be involved. The one thing that I always want to talk about is the resources, the financial resources, so that the firm that's representing you, okay, has the ability to be able to go out and get the experts also on your side for the plaintiff's side to prove your case. Because like you said, well, you're dealing with insurance companies that often have unlimited coffers. They're bringing in experts that are incredibly experienced and there's a credibility there. You also have to have that situation, okay? And people who are listening may not understand that, you know, I mean, you can't just look at somebody's law degree just because they went to an Ivy League school and say, okay, well, I'm going with this guy, when the fact of the matter is, you know, you really need to make sure that the firm itself has experience and does medical malpractice, has a great record of doing it, but also has the resources so that when that situation occurs, where you may have to go to court and there may be depositions involved, that you can go toe-to-toe with a big insurance company that has unlimited coffers to be able to make sure that you get experts that can prove your side of the case. Talk about that and the importance of understanding that you need a law firm with all those resources.
Yeah, well, there's that, you know, it's that may be the prime reason why a lot of law firms don't want to get involved in medical malpractice. They're extremely expensive, so you need to have the resources to be able to fund them. And then, you know, one thing that we haven't spoken about is that, you know, those are the malpractice cases are generally the cases that wind up in a courtroom. And there's a lot of reasons for that. But one of the reasons is that the medical community is has had a lot of successes defending themselves in the courtroom. And I started out by telling your listeners that, you know, one of the arguments is medicine's an imperfect science and you could do everything absolutely correctly and you've met the standard of care, and you can still be left with a bad result. And a lot of clients who call us, you know, have a hard time wrapping their head around that concept, because you see a doctor, and no doctor is going to guarantee a good result, because they just can't. You know, you go under the knife to fix a problem, there's no guarantee you're going to come out with a picture perfect, you know, result. And if you have a bad result, it could very well be because that's just what happened, that the doctor still met the standard of care and you still ultimately were left with a bad result. That's built into every doctor and hospital's defense, is that you can't blame us for this. This stuff happens. And one of the favorite defenses that you'll be presented with is that this is a risk to the procedure. And, you know, you sign those informed consent documents, and pretty much everything and the kitchen sink is included in what might happen during the course of this procedure. And it scares you. I mean, I've been presented with those things prior to a medical procedure. And here I am, a lawyer, and I'm reading them, and I'm like, oh, wow.
Well, John, you know what's interesting, though? You're very pro-doctor. Like, in other words, you're somebody who, like you said, your dad was a doctor, and, you know, so you're somebody in conversations. When I've talked to you many times about it, you know, I get that sense that, you know, you just care about getting things right. Okay. And one of those things, and tell me a little bit about this, because, and I was saying before you got on air, one of the things that has to be done when it comes to a medical malpractice case is there has to be a certification. Now, I am an iron worker. Okay. So I, you know, like, in other words, I don't, you know, I want, especially back when this certification process took place. Okay, so I can't say I was, understanding why it happened, but I'm going to take a shot right now and say the certification process probably ensures more that you have, lawyers that understand credible medical malpractice attorneys, and probably limits, fraudulent cases from being filed, when you have, so each case that just needs to be filed has to be certified to make sure it has merit, at least to have a lawsuit brought up. Talk about that process.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm boarded in, I'm licensed in New York, New Jersey, and Pennsylvania, and each state has its own pre-suit requirements. And when you file, generally speaking, you have to have a doctor review the case before you file it, whether it's one, two, or three doctors. They review the case, and then if it has, in Pennsylvania, they call it a reasonable probability standard. And if there's a reasonable probability that the standard of care was not met, which led to the injuries alleged, what happens is you have that document in hand, you can file your lawsuit, and then you file it with a certificate of merit, which just basically establishes
almost probable cause.
The standard of proof in a, you know, when a doctor or an expert gets up to testify, okay, at trial, he has to give an opinion within a reasonable degree of medical certainty, which is basically his opinion is based on his years of experience, what's in the literature, and based on that, you know, he has made an opinion within a reasonable degree of medical certainty that, you know, that the standard of care was either not met, and of course, which led to the injuries that are being alleged. But in the initial phase of it, is it's a reasonable probability, almost like, you know, more likely than not, that this led to what's being alleged. That, you know, and then if you get into discovery, which means you're getting into depositions and testimony prior to you know, going to trial, and your evidence doesn't lead you in the direction you may have thought it might lead you, you know, you could have an expert decide, you know what, I can't testify for you based on what has happened in this case. And then, you know, then you're left looking for another expert. But initially, that expert only has to, you know, based on his review of the records and the allegations, you know, as long as he can state that there's a reasonable probability that the standard of care was not met, which led to the injuries that are being alleged, you know, you're permitted to file a lawsuit. And the reason for that is, you know, years ago, at least this is what was argued, where there were lawsuits being filed alleging professional negligence, which is medical malpractice, and they were not already, you know, reviewed by an expert to support the allegations. Now, I never did that. I mean, that's nuts to file a lawsuit without having an expert look at it. But the argument was that this was happening. So the legislature years and years ago passed a law saying if you're going to file this malpractice cases, you know, this is what you have to do as a lawyer prior to filing a lawsuit. And quite frankly, that protects the medical community, that protects lawyers, because no one can allege that you filed a quote unquote frivolous lawsuit if you've had it reviewed by experts who say, no, the standard of care was not met. And as an attorney, you've done what you're required to do under the law to be able to file the lawsuit. Now, there might be a difference of opinion amongst the experts, but no one can argue that this is frivolous, which means there's no basis for the filing of the lawsuit. So, you know, that kind of been taken out of the equation.
What's amazing, John, when you look at this, just having this discussion, it reminds me, and it's a sports analogy you know, talking about Major League Baseball, right? Like they'll sit down and say, well, why don't more inner city kids play baseball? Well, you know, especially obviously the not that they don't play baseball, but when you know, athletes that have choices can go to play any sport, a lot of them don't pick baseball. They'll pick basketball or football or you know, one of those major sports. And the answer is, why don't they? Well, because there's four divisions of minor leagues before you get to the major leages, right? And so you got to go to rookie ball. You got to go to single A, double A, triple A. Okay. Well, it sounds like sort of like the same thing when it comes to medical malpractice. In other words, there's a lot of vetting and there's a lot of, you know, obviously certifications and all the, a lot of pre-gaming and certifications that you have to get before you can even file a lawsuit. So I imagine in that case, A, you want the best attorney possible, and B, you know, you clearly want to be able to have, you know, a firm that has the resources because, you know, like we talked about, it could be very expensive. So just, you know, I mean, this is...
Well, I'll do you one better. As an attorney, you can spend thousands of dollars trying to learn whether there's a case here.
Yeah.
And, you know, we've had cases where we've spent, I can't put a hard number on it, but we spent lots of money on cases only to learn that it's not a case.
Yeah.
And having to go to the client and say, listen, we can't do this case. And these people are devastated because they think they are entitled to pursue this case. And we tell them, you know, you might have to go contact another attorney. Fortunately, there's a lot of us out there and somebody else might have a difference of opinion.
Right. Well, it's a lot of money. You know, certainly For that process, it does explain why, attorneys with integrity, certainly, a lot of them refer. How often do you, when you get cases, John, do you get, are they, where do they, as far as referrals, do you get mostly attorney referrals?
I'd say in a malpractice context, people can find us online, word of mouth, which means either somebody had a professional experience with our firm,
right,
and a former client refers a client to us, or it'll come through another attorney. I'd say maybe a third of our medical malpractice cases come from other law firms.
Mm-hmm. And I respect those law firms because basically what they're saying is, look, this is a specialty, a big specialty. By the way, the civil sexual assault cases that the firm does, and we've done some shows a while back.
That's a specialty. That's a specialty. Trust me.
Exactly. That's my point. Like you guys take on some really incredibly serious stuff. I want to talk about the contingency fee right now because, to me, if I'm listening to the broadcast and we're talking about the cost of the, obviously the experts and all those things, I'm sitting here and I there's no way I could possibly afford that. And listening, obviously you're one of the better attorneys in the region. So how could I possibly, afford your services? What the people don't understand, a lot of them are, they don't have to worry about that. The contingency fee agreement, and this goes for even the firm comes out of pocket when it comes to paying for the experts, that the listener, the injured victim, does not have to come out of pocket for any of these expenses, including to retain you. Talk about that contingency fee agreement.
Yeah, and it works differently in each state. But a contingency fee agreement, the theory behind it is the attorney doesn't get to charge a fee. It's contingent on a positive result. So if you get a recovery for a client, you get a percentage of that recovery. Typically, fees can range from like a third to 40%. I mean, in a workers' comp context, the state has capped attorney's fees at 20%. But the idea is it opens up the courthouse doors for everyone because, let's face it, corporations and universities and the medical community have the ability to pay extraordinary lawyers extraordinary hourly fees. I mean, I'm not saying I take that back. They can afford to pay attorneys. What that hourly fee is, I don't know. But they can afford it. Person on the street, when somebody says go hire a lawyer, the first thing they think, well, I can't afford it. So you're not paying your attorney an hourly fee. You're paying that attorney only if he wins or obtains a recovery for you, which means settlement or verdict. And that allows people the ability to get very competent representation without worrying about getting hit with a bill. At the same time, a lawyer is not going to take a case that he doesn't think he's going to win, especially in the malpractice context, because, you could spend 3, 4, 5 years litigating the case. Let's try to stick with 2 or 3 years, but you could spend 2 or 3 years litigating the case. God forbid you lose it and you're out $100,000. I mean, that's an enormous hit. And, people hear about the wins, but no one talks about the losses. And if you're doing malpractice work, you're going to lose some cases. It's just the nature of the game.
Yeah.
There's an old saying, if you haven't lost the case, you haven't tried enough cases. And that pretty much applies to every lawyer who sees the courtroom on a regular basis.
So, when you say that, and that goes, that's why people need to have you know, you need to find the best, representation. Also, you and I have talked, and I've, you know, not just you and I, but I've talked often when you talk about, the success of a case, it's not just the case itself. So when you look at the totality of a case, it also matters, even though it shouldn't, where it's filed, right? So if it's filed in specific counties,
that's a really big issue. You've heard of venue shopping, judge shopping. That's the nature of our business, fortunately or unfortunately. You see it, in the political world where, if you're looking to pass or support conservative legislation and you're taken to court, you're hoping that you're in front of a federal judge who has conservative leanings. And that's why you see a lot of some of the laws that have been challenged oftentimes find themselves in places like Texas and so forth, where you're going to get a more conservative judge and a better opportunity to support your legislation. Let's say if it's conservative versus if it's more progressive, you're going to want to be in a different circuit. So that game is, it's not even a game, but that effort is used in our politics, but also as a lawyer who has an office and needs to sit down and say, well, where would this case be most filed, which would give my client the most favorable opportunity for a verdict? Okay, and generally speaking, and no one's going to argue with me. A plaintiff has the best shot of obtaining a successful result.
In Philadelphia County.
In Philadelphia County. And let me be very careful when I say this. The verdicts in Philly are higher than they are in other counties in Pennsylvania, and you don't really need me to tell you that. All you have to do is look at the statistics. And I think when you have the threat of being hit with a large verdict and you're a defendant, that's going to motivate you to try to resolve your case.
I guess there's statistics. The statistics say this. So this isn't just your opinion.
I'm not making this up. I mean, any lawyer will tell you that if you have the opportunity to be able to file your lawsuit in Philadelphia, you're going to want to do that versus filing it in the middle of the state where plaintiff's verdicts are hard to come by. There are counties in the state where maybe you've never ever rendered a verdict for the plaintiff. I had a case, and it's not just limited to Pennsylvania. I had a case in New Jersey a year or two ago where I was able to secure a settlement, and one of the, my clients, I don't think were all that happy with the result, even though, in my view, it was a pretty decent number. But the threat of losing the case, which was, again, in my view and in my client's view, very meritorious, had a lot of merit. Otherwise, they wouldn't have offered money to us. But nevertheless, it might not have been as much as they would have liked. But the threat of losing was so significant that you're going to you're going to settle that case versus if you're in a jurisdiction where you're going to potentially get a higher verdict. Then from the defendant standpoint, you don't want to pay that much, but you're concerned about having a verdict. And then you might be, again, for lack of a word, encouraged to get to the settlement table and negotiate a settlement. I mean, and this is the nature of our business. I mean, venue is an enormous factor in these cases.
And that goes to the defense and the plaintiff. Let me throw something at you, okay?
Let me just say one thing, because one of the things that, you know, you can make the other argument, well, is justice. You get the same justice in Philly as you would in a more conservative county. You know, that's subject to debate, you know, and everybody has a different of opinion. And it's not limited to Pennsylvania. I mean, you can go to Florida, California. I mean, every state has different demographics, and every state is going to potentially determine your chances of victory.
So
in a courtroom,
one of the things when I think about it is, you know, typically speaking, first of all, you talk about accountability. The reason why, okay, it's vital, and this is just me, a layman, okay, but I've done a lot of these broadcasts, and I've had the pleasure of and I'm just thinking of you know, just justice. And when I think about what you do, John, and I've heard, you know, you care, by the way, you and I have done shows where you want more, you know, you're talking to state reps and state senators about having the emergency rooms, you know, obviously having more doctors, having them more prepared, because you know you champion that, you know, the medical community and doctors and all that things, because hey, we're all going to be in there one time, and we want the best, and we want the best for our family, and we want
what we've learned from our conversations with our one friend in the House who's sponsoring a bill, is one of the reasons why you wait so long in an emergency room is not because there's not enough beds in the inn. There's just not enough people at the inn that can help you.
Yes.
And you're sitting there waiting because they don't have enough staff to attend to all the people that are waiting in the emergency room. And, you know, that's a conversation for a different day.
And it is, but let me just say why it's important, okay? Well, because you're advocating for those services, but one of the things that you do as a medical malpractice attorney is keep the medical community accountable, okay? And I don't care what community it is, okay? I was in the damn nightclub business, for 15 years, and we would sit there and argue about if we should put a security guard at the back door, okay? It's a Thursday night, mm-hmm. Not a lot going on. Until somebody got hurt because somebody snuck in that back door, and now all of a sudden we need to be held accountable for protecting our people. Well, what you do, change happens in the courtroom, okay? And by the way, we're going to get into some of those type of situations. But what you do is keep the medical community, because it's, you know, this, you're talking about such a high risk situation, hospitals. Accountable. I remember when I was in the hospital, John, I'll never forget this as long as I live. I had an issue with my knee. It turned into be an infection several years ago. And I was at the one hospital, and it wasn't going well. So they, because we asked them, would you go to another hospital? And the doctor there who had a dual, she also had she also had an office at another hospital. She said, I would go there. We took her advice. We went there, okay, and I'll never forget. I had great doctors, awesome. They did a great job. But I remember just being interviewed by six or seven different vendors, and I realized that they were asking the same questions, and I'm like, okay, there's a lot of moving parts here. I can, and they all did a great job, but my point is, does the left hand know what the right hand's doing? I was, you know, so there's so many moving parts that keeping people accountable is the only way it happens, because unfortunately, you know, there have been some very difficult situations that have been occurred, and the only reason why we put a security guard, I'm not just giving us an example, that back door, is because we got hit with a lawsuit. Okay, and somebody got hurt, of course, and that we were mindful of that and caring about that. But in this situation, it's the same sort of situation. Keeping accountable, change happens in the courtroom. And when you get settlements for people or verdicts, it's for so they can live the rest of their life. They're not going to Atlantic City and partying. And you know, somebody may have lost the ability to work. It may be a wrongful death. There may be, you know, economic issues for children. All that. I mean, there are so many factors. It's not just about sitting there getting, you know, like hitting the lottery. This is about getting, you know, allowing somebody to live with dignity or their family members because there's a lost income due to a negligent situation. And you and it's interesting because the more I listen to you, the more I learned it. It's safeguarded to the best of the ability. And what does that mean? Well, you guys even certify the cases. So another, you take every precaution possible to make sure that this is a legitimate case. Okay. And then, you know, justice and it's not just about the, it's not just about the settlement, but the settlement or the verdict that it helps, like we said, replaces income that the breadwinner may have had to, you know, to live with dignity, to be able to pay for their hospital and their medical for the rest of their life, to be able to have the money that they used to have when they were working for the rest of their life, because now they can't work in many cases, we're just being hypothetical, to raise their families. Okay, so I like to always make sure that that's in there, because otherwise, you know, people don't understand really what medical malpractice is and why you have to do that. And why these cases are vital. Okay. So when they talk about tort reform, no one's running around saying people want to sue doctors or medical. No, but we have to keep the system accountable, just like every system out there. Otherwise, you know, like it's a, you know, I'm being, you know, but, you know, cigarettes, there are people in graves because of cigarettes, that outlast all the wars, okay? My point is somebody had to bring that to justice to save lives so it doesn't happen to somebody else. And talk about that point, John, and the fact that, you know, a lot of times, you know, you're not only seeking justice for your clients so that they can live with dignity and for the lost income that they've had, but also so these situations, to the best of your ability, don't happen to somebody else.
I think accountability is something that keeps everybody honest, so to speak. Everybody wakes up and wants to do a good job. No one says, oh, I'm not going to take this client seriously, or I'm not going to take this patient seriously. I'm just going to go about my business and give them 50% effort. I believe in my heart that everybody wants to do a good job, and they want to do an honest job. And that aside, accountability keeps you somewhat focused, because you know that if you don't meet the standard of care, you more than likely will be held accountable. And, you know, that's something that I think everybody's aware of. I mean, I think that it's built into our legal system. I mean, you go out and commit a crime. One of the reasons why, you know, people aren't running around robbing banks, you know, aside from the fact that it's illegal, is you're going to be held accountable.
Exactly.
If you get caught, you're going to pay a steep price for it. I mean, there's accountability in our criminal justice system, and there's accountability in our civil justice system, and it's designed to protect the public. I mean, for the most part, there's accountability in our politics. You know, if you're a congressman and you don't represent your constituents the way they want you to represent them, you're going to get voted out of office. So to some extent, everybody's kind of looking over their shoulder. You know, you don't want to be paranoid. You don't want to be practicing defensive medicine, because that's not good either. And some doctors, I think, may order that extra test just to be safe, when in retrospect, it really was unnecessary. And what happens then? Well, that drives up insurance costs. And that's why insurance companies now are saying, well, you have to get everything pre-approved or we're not paying for it.
Well,
I mean,
it's
all built into the system.
One of the things, and we're going to get into, we only got like 10 minutes left, but I just want to say this. So, you know, you mentioned, you know, and you have great interest in making sure that you know, that the legislation that where we have enough doctors, okay, enough professionals in our emergency rooms, okay, you have great interest in making sure that that happens. But one of the things I've seen, I've done a lot of shows on it, especially years ago, as hedge funds have taken over hospitals, okay, you have situations where, you know, you may have a shortage of manpower, woman power, okay, nursing power, okay, and your loved one or you are headed to an emergency room where you don't even know it, where there's a labor dispute, okay, and it might be because of a lack of manpower. And I've heard of situations because there's a labor dispute, because the hedge fund is profits over patients, you know, they're undermanning and understaffing. And now you have a potential, and it's hypothetical, but, you know, it's not really, and where you have nurses that are learning pieces of equipment on certain floors because the persons that are experts, you know, they're cutting their shifts. And so, you know, there are a lot of different areas where like medicine and the law. I mean, medicine and our medical profession is so important. We got so many great people in it, but it's like a loaded gun. And if so because it's so personal and because our health's on the line, the standard of care is vital. And so the accountability process is important. John, tell me, are there a specific type of medical malpractice cases? Like when you look at the different types of medical malpractice cases, give me an idea of a lot of the ones that are, I'm going to say most prevalent, if you would, that happen the most, or at least that you see.
That's a hard question.
Well, can I throw some at you?
I could probably tell you where the chance of something happening would be in an ER situation.
Yeah.
Where they miss something because you're in a high stakes emergency setting, and if you're going to ask me what?
Well, can I throw some at you?
Go ahead.
Okay, and we're not going to have to go. We only got like 7 minutes, so I want to get down to a question where, you know, how often in a percentage that do these cases actually go to trial? Because I heard it's relatively low compared to the amount of cases that actually are filed. But let me just say this. I have just, and this is a layman talking, but, you know, misdiagnosis of cancer situations, birth injuries, obviously medical, medication mistakes, surgical errors, And of course, in ER situations, are they areas that are prevalent in, and I'm sure there's a gazillion areas, okay? But are they areas where you might see a lot more, activity in filing med mal cases?
Wait, I you lost me.
What's the misdiagnosis of cancer?
Make sure I got it right.
Misdiagnosis
cancer that happens.
Birth
maybe in
injuries.
The context of birth injuries is a whole different monster. And there's plaintiff's lawyers out there that have had subspecialties in birth injury cases. You want to talk about how things can go wrong as that baby's coming through the birth canal. I mean, you can have all kinds of things happen, unfortunately. And when that happens, the injuries are catastrophic. I can't tell you in my own personal practice if I see more cases of one particular specialty than others. I mean, I have ER cases where something happened in the ER or something was missed in the ER and then something extraordinarily tragic happens. I've had orthopedic cases. Now those cases are tough because, you come in with a terribly bad orthopedic injury, and you've already got a lot of problems to begin with, and now you're going to argue that, you know, I have this big problem because the doctor didn't do it correctly. A lot of times your fracture or your situation, which required surgery, was already so bad that even if the doctor did everything correctly, you're still left with the residuals of the underlying trauma. And, you know, but it's one of those classic examples of, you know, I wanted a perfect result. I didn't get it. And then they call a lawyer and, you know, you're like, well, wait a minute. You already had this problem. How do we know that this problem wouldn't still exist if not for, even if the surgery, you know, even if the surgery was completely perfectly done, you could still be left with these problems. And a lot of doctors will say that, especially in spine surgeries and those types of surgeries, because if you got, you know, 10, 20 years of degenerative disc disease and somebody goes in and does surgery to help you with that problem, 10 to 1, you're still having, you might not have as much of a problem, but you might still be having some of those issues. And we get those calls, and I generally don't pursue those cases. But the tragic cases are a lot of the ER cases or the cancer cases, and the cancer cases are particularly hard because a lot of times you are representing a client who comes to your office and they're walking, talking, they're able to explain everything to you. And over a course of two or three years,
they're not going to be there for the end.
You see how they deteriorate, and it's haunting. I mean, I had a case years ago with one of the other attorneys in this office, and during the course of our representation, the guy passed away, and it was a cancer case where they missed something, and it wound up metastasizing, and he died, and that was horrible because we went from seeing this family together and watching this man deteriorate and seeing how this devastated his family and his wife in particular, how it impacted her life, where she had two young girls at home. And you get really wrapped up into their lives, and it's hard not to separate. You know, you go home and you bring it home with you.
And John, is there added responsibility there? Because the weight of their world very, very well may be on your shoulders.
Oh, God, yes. I mean, it's heavy. It actually brings you down. And you feel this enormous sense of responsibility where you have to get them you want to get them a recovery that provides for them going forward. At the same time, a lot of times, you know, taking a case to trial, and if you lose, you know, how do you look at these two little girls and say, I'm sorry, we did the best we could?
Sure.
When you had the opportunity to settle the case and secure their future as best as you can. And that pressure alone is enough to get you to the settlement table and say, all right, at least we know for sure that you're going to be taken care of.
Right.
And you don't take that decision or that responsibility lightly. It's heavy.
And John, boy, you said it incredibly well. We only got 2 minutes left. I wanted to just ask one question. Of all medical cases that, I mean, this is not medical malpractice cases filed. And it doesn't have to be exact, but percentages that actually go to trial?
Well, I'm going to use my personal practice as an example. In all the years, and I've been doing this for quite some time, and I would say in the last 10 years, 75% of my professional time is spent on medical malpractice cases. I have had only maybe one or two cases where I was able to actually settle the cases without filing a lawsuit. In one case, I actually drafted a lawsuit and sent it to, I knew who the counsel was for the particular hospital. And I said, you know, you might want to take a look at this. you know, why don't you take a look at this and talk to your risk people and see if we can work this out. And it was something that was tragic at a hospital, and they came to me and offered to settle it without having to litigate it. And that was enormous.
John,
so if you ask me the percentage, I would say most of them go to trial. How's that?
So, John, real quick, contact information if somebody wants to get in touch.
SullivanZermanos.com. My name is John Zermanos. You can call us at 732-2260. I also have a direct dial number at 445-456-2707.
All right. Well, I want to thank you for obviously a fantastic show. I want to thank everybody for tuning in to the Saul Offer and Zervano Show here on WWDB Talk 860. On behalf of John Zervanos, I'm Joe Dougherty. And a shout out to Shane, our producer. Thanks for listening.